Good morning. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Outcomes Steering Committee conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Reva Winkler, you may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you, everyone, and welcome. This is a conference call of the N2F Patient Outcomes Main Steering Committee, and I'd like to introduce and turn it over to our co-chairs, Joyce DeBow and Lee Fleischer.
Thank you, Reva. Welcome, yes. Everybody. Lee?
Yep. Thank you, Reva, and welcome.
Reva, the one item of business we need to address before we can plunge into the measures is the disclosures of conflicts. Do you want to just give everybody an opportunity by calling the roll?
Be best, Reva. Can you do that?
Yeah, I can run the roll just quickly. What we're looking for is any potential involvement in the measure development or potential conflicts with the measures being discussed today and not necessarily anything else in the project. So it'd be important if anyone identify those. Be aware that we are recording this conference call, and the recording will be posted on the NQF website and for transparency, and that's why the disclosures are such an important part of it. So, Joyce DeBow?
Nothing to report.
Lee Fleischer?
Nothing to report.
Reuben Amerensingham?
Nothing to report.
Larry Becker? Not here. Okay. Dr. Dellinger?
I haven't been involved in any of the measure development. This is my first NQF call, and I'm not 100% sure. I have lots of commercial entities involved in antibiotics that I have worked with over the last 2 years, but I'm not clear whether that's relevant to this process.
All right. We'll take note of that, but I don't think we need the details at this point in time. If anything arises where you think there could be, we'd appreciate it if you'd mention it.
Okay.
Yes, but it sounds like if it's antibiotics, it's not relevant to these measures.
Right. Okay.
All right. Ann Deutsch?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. Brian Filippo? Okay, not here. Linda Gerbig?
Nothing to disclose.
Fine. Ted Gibbons?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. Sheldon Greenfield? Not here. Linda Groh? Not here. Pat Haugen?
Nothing to report.
Great. David Herman? Okay. David Hopkins?
Nothing to report.
Great. Dion Jewell?
Nothing to disclose.
Thank you. David Johnson?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. Ivor Juster?
Nothing to disclose.
Thank you. Bert Keeley? Not here. Pauline McNulty?
What am I supposed to disclose? I was a few minutes waiting for the operator to get me in.
Oh, thank you. Glad you're here. Any involvement in the measure development or anything that could pose a potential conflict in evaluating the measures that are on the agenda for today?
None.
Thank you. Lee Newcomer?
Employee of United Health Group, one of our divisions in Genix, may eventually use these measures as a reporting, but I don't think it will conflict with anything we're talking about today.
Thank you very much. Vanita Pendolia?
Disclose.
Okay. Amy Rosen?
Here. I have nothing to disclose.
Thank you, Amy. Barbara Turner?
No conflicts.
Thank you. Barbara Yon?
Nothing to disclose.
Super. Thank you all very much. Lee and Joyce, with your permission, I'd like to just go over a couple of general things before we get into the measure discussion. I want to just some brief overview comments. As I mentioned before, this call is being recorded and will be posted for transparency. The purpose of today's call is for the steering committee to have an opportunity to discuss six measures that are going through the NQF consensus development process under the Patient Outcomes Project. This is sort of the steering committee's point of discussion for final evaluation of the major outcome criteria and recommendation on whether the measure should go forward for endorsement. So this is an important decision-making call for the steering committee. However, we will not be voting on today's call. Voting on conference calls is logistically time-consuming and difficult. We, as I've mentioned to you before, we will be capturing your final votes for decision-making using a SurveyMonkey tool. We'll send you the link to that after this call. So it would be useful if you were taking notes on how you're going to want to register your votes on the for the four main criteria as well as your recommendation for endorsement.
Reva?
Yes.
Just a quick question on process here. So if we have questions for the developers that and need more information before we can vote, is that possible?
Yes. What I'll do is time the voting based on that sort of discussion, and we'll figure that out by the end of the call today.
Thank you.
But you should raise those issues today.
Right.
Right. Just a brief summary of where we've been. These measures were submitted by various measure developers. We have three sets of measure developers with us today, associated with two measures each. They are available for steering committees to ask questions or clarifications, so they are with us. These measures were reviewed by two different technical advisory panels, both pulmonary technical advisory panel and the cardiovascular technical advisory panel. Summaries of their ratings of the sub-criteria have been provided to the steering committee for your review on each of the measures. For some of the questions of the TAP, the measure developers have responded to some questions and provided additional information or data or analyses, and that information has been provided to you. In addition, because outcome measures are often quite complex, including risk adjustment models, for this project, we have the assistance of Dr. Sean O'Brien, who is from the Duke Medical Center and Duke Clinical Research Institute. He's a biostatistician, and he is helping the steering committee by providing some analysis of the risk adjustment models for those measures that have risk adjustment models, and Sean is here with us, and so he is available for questions, but you have received his summary of the risk models for those measures that do have risk models. So a large amount of information has come your way, and we appreciate your forbearance in trying to juggle it all. Lastly, a portion of the steering committee members participated in a bit of a straw vote that we asked the group to weigh in on to get some preliminary sense of where the issues were for each of these measures. That summary was provided to the steering committee a couple of days ago. So these are all pieces of information to help us focus our discussion on the issues that have been raised heretofore and hopefully keep this conversation focused and valuable for steering committee members to assist in their decision making. At this point, I'd just ask if there are any questions before we launch into major discussion. Okay, hearing none, what we'd like to do to try and help in time management is go through the measures, and I am going to just introduce each measure by a brief description of the measure as well as the issues that have been raised, and then turn it back to the co-chairs to lead the discussion of the steering committee members. We are going to start a little bit out of order from the agenda that might have been posted. We're going to start with the ICU measures. These have been brought to us from University of San Francisco. Dr. Adams Dudley is on the line as the measure developer for assistance. So the first one we will look at is OT1023, intensive care unit length of stay, described as for all patients admitted to the ICU, the total duration of time spent in the ICU until the time of discharge, both observed and risk-adjusted length of stay, reported with the predicted LOS measured using an adjustment risk model based on the mortality probability model. With this submission is several publications of the model in peer-reviewed journals, most recently in the journal CHEST in 2009. They've also submitted the data collection tool and the data dictionary. The pulmonary technical advisory panel reviewed this measure, and they noted for the important subcriteria that this was an important outcome. It's a costly area of hospital care. There is national data on variation length of stay. This measure is currently used in the voluntary hospital reporting program in California, the CHART program, where it's reported by 246 hospitals, each reporting up to 400 patients per year. Under scientific acceptability, the TAP again rated this measure quite high. It does have a published risk model that has been used. Dr. O'Brien's evaluation of the risk model you can read in detail, but his summary comments for the most part were that the analytic methods and documentation are generally excellent. Possible issues include comparison to alternative models and a question about handling of missing data. Otherwise, I think the one issue that was raised by the steering committee and again by the measure developer is an issue around identifying the time of onset for starting an ICU stay, particularly if patients that are in the emergency room, receiving intensive care services, or in the post-acute or the post-anesthesia care unit. Discussion centered around a lot of the variation and differences in hospital structure and how they move patients through various units and levels of care. The physical risk-adjusted model, it is currently being, for usability, it's currently being used in California by hospitals. There is a plan for it to be included in public reporting through CHART. In terms of feasibility, it was felt it is very compatible with EHR use, and some vendors have actually built it in. However, most hospitals use abstraction because EHR adoption is quite slow, but it certainly will be feasible when they do adopt it. CHART also has electronic submission software available for use. So, in general, the evaluations have been quite good of this measure. Joyce, I'll send it back to you for discussion.
Well, I open it up to the steering committee. Are there any questions? Remember, we have the measure developer on the phone.
This is Dave Johnson. How do you co-adjust for intensity of disease and referral bias in tertiary referral settings?
Hi, this is Adam Sedley from the University of California, San Francisco. We have, in the submitted documentation, we have several peer-reviewed articles in which we've compared this model to others and also asked the question of what hospital characteristics have an impact on assessed performance. And it turns out that teaching status doesn't seem to have much of an impact because regardless of the model used, this one or any other, teaching hospitals have much higher predicted mortality rates. So they have higher observed mortality rates, but they also have quite a bit higher predicted mortality rates. And so the risk seems to be captured through this model.
Any other questions?
One question I have, and I like the measure very much, but one question would be...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Sure. This is Ruben Omersingham from Dallas, Texas. One question that we've observed, just sort of anecdotally, is that in safety net hospitals, sometimes there's cultural aspects that could affect the length of stay. And I'm curious why there wasn't any risk adjustment based on race or ethnicity or socioeconomic status.
I agree with you that it's not just possible but likely that those things would have some impact. Unfortunately, we just don't have a good data source for them. We don't have a good way of capturing those variables and including them in a model. In general, the data source that is currently used by all ICU models is collecting data from the patient when they arrive at the intensive care unit, and race isn't collected at that time. We do have one possible alternative for race. We don't have any alternative for socioeconomic status. That's just not a variable that's addressed in any hospital database or collected at the time of hospital admission. We do have two one proxy variable for socioeconomic status, and that is uninsured or Medi-Cal. We have found that that hasn't been a major impact in our models. We have a paper submitted but not yet published where we've looked at the impact of race, ethnicity on ICU outcomes and are not actually finding much difference. But that race, ethnicity variable comes from hospital admission, and what's going on there is the person admitting the patient to the hospital just looks at them and assigns a race based on that, and sometimes they don't assign a race at all. So there are more issues of missing variables with that, or missing data with that, and because you know, it's America is getting ever more diverse, it's harder and harder for a person to just look at the patient being admitted and decide what race, ethnicity they are at, accurately. So that may be why we're not seeing much identifiable impact from race, ethnicity.
And I know, this is Ruben again, I know
perhaps
that...
Perhaps, since this will become an issue in almost every discussion, Reva, maybe Helen, if she's willing,
yes.
could comment on NQF's approach, and we can discuss that for a moment.
Thanks, Lee. I just got off mute for that exact reason. Hi, it's Helen Burstyn from NQF. Actually, if you look at our measure evaluation criteria that we shared with you, we have a sub-criteria specifically indicating our preference to not include measures race, ethnicity in the risk adjustment models, but our preference for stratification to allow disparities to be identified rather than adjusted.
Right, and I'm fine with either, and I know the value of not adjusting necessarily, but at least stratifying.
Yep.
One question would be, and I know Dr. Dudley has been quite sensitive to this issue, and the JAMA paper that he published with Rachel Werner on the impact of pay-for-performance measures and how they may affect hospitals that tend to take care of more of these patients, I know that he's sensitive to this issue. So I guess one question would be, you know, if this measure is sort of approved and we go forward, would there be possibility of in the ICU data collection tool or going forward that some of this information may be collected? Because I think I read in the technical documentation that that it was possible that this could be added to the ICU collection tool for stratification purposes.
That could be added to the ICU collection tool, or alternatively, in states that do collect it, more attention could be paid to making sure that it's done correctly at the point of hospital admission.
This is Barbara Turner. I'd actually like to push a little bit more on this stratification, because it sounds like you don't have a good measure to stratify on. And I'm wondering a little bit about creative thinking in terms of zip code and neighborhood income, which you can get from the census, perhaps. I do think that insurance type is usually very predictive of resource use and outcomes, and I think we shouldn't be satisfied with the evidence we've heard so far about that. And I feel like we need to use these measures as a way of getting us to do a better job of collecting SES and racial ethnic information. So I endorse the idea of further work on it.
This is Dave Johnson again. Real quick question. You mentioned it, Reva, in the introduction, I think, but didn't hear how it was resolved. Length of stay, so I'm concerned about how the developer pushes the start button because of the ICUs are over the country are overwhelmed. So there's frequently people are still in the ER for extended periods of time. So how do you accurately define the start time?
Adams, I'll let you field that one.
What we currently do is we use the admission to the ICU. And so you're right that it creates the possibility that people could be kept down in the emergency room getting ICU care. One of the issues is that we think that the ICU length of stay measure shouldn't be used alone, that it should be used with an outcomes measure. I believe the next measure we're going to discuss is our mortality measure. Is that correct, Reva?
Yes, correct.
So the idea is that these things are a suite. Our concern is that people put kept down in the emergency room for a long time won't do as well because they don't really have the full resources of the intensive care unit available to them, and that using these measures as a suite would balance those pressures. To some extent, ICU throughput and making sure that people get into the ICU when they need to is a performance issue. It's our feeling that you want to hold the hospitals responsible for getting people out of the emergency room, but because that's such a hard thing to measure, the likely most efficient way, we think, to get to that kind of accountability is to measure the outcome that you're wanting, the absence of death, and combining it with the measure of utilization, the length of stay measure.
Reva, can you tell us how we how the committee can craft its recommendation if it decides to go forward with this measure to, for example, be sure that there's a recommendation that pairs this measure with the companion measure, and as well as any other recommendations? I mean, just please give us some guidance on that.
Well, I think the pairing is something that I can include as a subvote when you vote to approve or not the measure itself, because that's not something that requires anybody to do more than the way we compile it for publication and distribution to pair those measures together in a one-way pairing situation. So that's fairly straightforward, and I can include that as a subvote for the committee to weigh in on.
Is there any disagreement among the committee members about doing that?
This is Barbara Yawn. When we talk about these as outcome measures, and I thought that's what we're supposed to be doing, is looking at outcome measures. But yet I hear you, Adam, saying, well, wait a minute, this isn't an outcome measure as it stands. The mortality measure has to go with it to make it an outcome measure. And I think that is of concern and has been of concern all along. The other thing, when you say that, Adam, in the mortality measure, you remove burn patients, you remove CABG patients, and you remove trauma patients. Are you suggesting that they should also then be removed from this measure of length of stay?
Hi, this is Adam Steadley, and yes, we were. These two measures come from the exact same patient populations. And I'm sorry if I was unclear about whether or not this is an outcome measure. I feel like it is one kind of outcome measure, and mortality is another kind of outcome measure. This outcome measure gets at efficiency and utilization, and the mortality gets at the what I think of as more clinical outcome. And I think what we're trying to achieve, and the reason we imagine these being paired, is that I think there's concern that if you just measured length of stay alone for this or any, this is actually a general issue, I think, in inpatient setting. If you just measured how fast you get people out the hospital, you would create an incentive to get them out perhaps too sick and not ready to go. And so
Excuse me, Adams. Could everybody put their phone on mute, please, so we don't hear background noise?
Somebody put us on hold, Joyce.
Oh. All right. Well, don't do that, but just do it on mute. Sorry, Adams.
Sure, no problem. So I think this is actually a general issue for any measure that addresses utilization, is that you don't want the utilization measure then to drive towards things that are undesired, like people leaving too sick. And so that's the rationale for this. It's to match a clinical outcome with a utilization outcome. So I guess they are both outcomes, they're just one is financial and one is clinical.
And that's been a topic of repeated conversation at various NQF venues in the past, that efficiency measures and resource use measures be paired with some indication of what the clinical quality is as well.
Reva, so, this is Adam. I'm sorry.
This is Annie Rosen. I agree with Adam Studley and think that we should use the length of stay measure along with the mortality measure, that they should be endorsed together rather than separately.
This is Linda Gerbig. I would agree. The length of stay measure is explanatory and supports the mortality measure. taken independently, I think they would both be of much less value.
This is DeAngelo. I think I have a clarifying question. So I agree with the concept of pairing the two, but as a group, these measures are really kind of like the best analogy I can think of is canaries in a coal mine, right? I mean, if there's a problem, if a hospital's off the mark on these, it doesn't specify what the source of the problem is quality-wise. A drill down would have to follow, correct?
This is Adam Studley. Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
We currently in California, we actually have some additional process measures, and the next time there's a call for process measures, we can submit those.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And this is Ivor Juster from Active Health. Quick question. It mentioned in the measure submission form that since this was a cost and utilization related outcome measure, that days in the ICU beyond, I think it was after the third day, the cost curve declined. And therefore, a mean like 3.7 might not accurately distinguish the number of days, trying to get at this point of diminishing return. You know, if the organization were able to improve it from 3.7 to 3.6, that might be almost nothing compared to 2.1 to 2.0. Is there some way to get at that concern about the point of diminishing return from improving an outcome? Because it costs money to improve an outcome.
Dr. Dudley?
So this is Adam Studley. I think for the current data collection that we have, we don't have any mechanism for getting cost data from the intensive care units. I think it's almost certain to be true that there will be more cost in the initial day because everything's being stabilized. But we can't give you figures for exactly how that curve plays out. I think as a starting point, getting a handle on length of stay and its variation and identifying people who can reduce that is probably worth doing. And then if we get to the point, I hope we someday get to the point of saying what's the next utilization reduction and is the benefit, the financial benefit of further utilization greater than the cost of it. But I think we're so far away from that cut point right now that I wouldn't think it would be a major concern for the committee.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. It's just something to put on our to-do list for the future.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Lee. The only thing I would be concerned, which this measure does accurately capture, is readmission to the ICU, and that it captured total days. So it would not be a simplistic model to actually look at time from the beginning. My one question to Reva is, if the committee felt strongly about capturing SES data in some form or race, how does that play out as far as the vote?
Okay. I think the question I would ask Adams is that something that is doable immediately? And I'm going to just not put him too much on the spot, but guess that it would take some time for them to be able to implement it, such that it would be outside the time frame of our project evaluation, so that I think it can be made as a very strong recommendation. But if you want the measure to go forward, I think you'll have to accept it as it is and just make that a recommendation for future. If you want to make it a condition and they're not able to do it in the next 2 weeks, then that's a no vote.
This is Adam Sobey. Is it appropriate for me to comment on this now?
Sure. Yes, please.
So if I said anything that suggested that we're any worse off than anyone else in measuring socioeconomic status or race, ethnicity, I think I created a misimpression. This is a problem for all inpatient measures, is that there's never been a reason to make certain that race, ethnicity could be collected correctly. It didn't used to be hard 50 years ago when there were fewer categories and fewer people in those categories, but it's gotten much more difficult now. And then socioeconomic status has never been a collected variable. So in my mind, there's nothing specific to these particular measures about that problem. It's, as someone pointed out earlier, it's a problem that my group has worried about and worked on a lot over the years, and we're going to continue to work on it. But I think if you were to say that we can't move outcome measures forward until they've adequately dealt with race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic impact on outcomes, then you wouldn't have anything that you could move forward today.
Could I get a sense of the committee on where we stand on this issue about whether this should be a condition or a strong, either a strong recommendation or a condition for endorsement?
Can I ask? Repeat what the condition is, please?
The condition would be to require the capture of the SES data in the measure. I mean, that would be the requirement. It would be a condition for endorsement as opposed to a strong recommendation that the measure developer move in that direction to.
We've never done that with any other measure, and I don't think we should start here. This is David Hopkins speaking.
Okay. This is Barbara Yon. If I knew how to tell them to do it, I wouldn't mind, but I have no idea what we would use either for SES or for race, since there are multiracial groups now quite commonly. So I think we say, please work on it, but everybody is.
Anybody else?
This is Pat Dellinger.
I think it should be a requirement for endorsement.
I'm sorry. We heard too many people at the same time.
This is Patch Dellinger. What about just collecting patient zip code?
Dr. Dudley?
That is possible. There's some sensitivity about that because when you combine a birth date with a zip code and a diagnosis, in many zip codes, you get down to levels of being able to identify individual patients. And then zip code is a poor proxy for socioeconomic status. If you think about your own zip code, there's probably a lot of variation in that. So it's not a very powerful variable, and it comes at some cost in terms of potential privacy issues. Nonetheless, it is one of many things that people are, you know, we're doing geocoding and investigating whether it's possible to improve the hospital's collection of race, ethnicity, and so forth. I think all those things need to be further investigated and even new data sources considered. But I don't think anyone for any measure is there yet.
Okay, so unless there's anybody who wants to speak to the other side of that, it sounds to me as though there were two strong recommendations that we have for this measure. One is to strongly recommend continued effort to capture the SES data in the measure with indirect estimation methods or whatever. And two, for this measure to be paired, are there any other recommendations that we want to make?
And just to be clear on the first one, we're not suggesting that that be incorporated directly into the risk adjustment, right?
No. I thought that was settled as an N2F policy. No, I thought that was clear.
Okay.
But
this is Barbara. The second one, I feel quite strongly that using one of these without the other is not appropriate. You can just see pay for performance based on shorter stays, but then they have higher mortality. So I think the combination is crucial to good outcomes and good patient care.
This is Adam Sedley.
So Reva and Helen, can you help us understand the strength of the recommendation with respect to pairing and the endorsement of these two measures as individual measures? In other words, the mortality measure you understand?
Yeah, the concept of pairing is something NQF has used for many years with the intent that when we put forth a measure that's paired, they travel together. In other words, they don't get voted on independently. They get voted on as the pair together. So they rise and fall together for endorsement, and we publish it that way, and we say everything we can about that the intent of the endorsement is that they travel, that they are used together. Ultimately, what happens in the field isn't something we always have a great deal of control over, but that would be the way we would handle it if you vote to pair it.
Okay.
This is Adam Sedley. Can I ask about a slight tweak on that?
Mm-hmm.
It's our opinion that the pairing or the conditional approval should be one way, but not the other. So we wouldn't ever want to see anyone using length of stay without mortality. But if people were to decide, you know, all we care about is mortality, and we're not going to worry about the utilization measure, it seems like
that's a
decision people could make. So we don't. Mm-hmm. What we would do is put the condition of pairing on the length of stay measure only, but not the other way around.
Rita, can we stipulate it that way?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Is there any discussion about that among the committee members? Because I think we have to move on to the next measure.
Right.
Any further discussion? Okay. Mortality.
Yeah. This is essentially the parent measure that we've been talking a great deal about anyway when we were talking about the length of stay measure. This measure for ICU mortality uses the same model. The same issues were raised around handling race and ethnicity. And so essentially, even though it's a mortality model, most of the issues you've been talking about have been addressed for this measure as well.
Discussion?
This is Barbara. My only quick question to Adam is, remind us why you took CABG out and not other kinds of surgeries that commonly go to the ICU post-op?
Because many states these days have their own CABG-specific risk adjustment model, either developed by themselves or by the Society for Thoracic Surgeons. For the record, CABG is coronary artery bypass grafting. And so it didn't make sense to do data collection on those patients twice, and the CABG-specific model, not surprisingly, is better for CABG patients.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Linda Burby.
Same issue with trauma and burn. They have their own risk adjustment model.
Right. Those were clearer, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Linda. Could I ask about the inclusion or exclusion of behavioral patients?
Ask away.
They don't appear to be excluded, but we frequently see particularly attempted suicide patients in the ICUs.
They are included.
They are included.
Yes, they are.
And has any time study been done on the additional amount of time taken in the ICU to collect the data elements or also to abstract the data elements?
Yes. These measures and their use in California grew out of a study my group did in the California Intensive Care Outcomes Network, where we compared this measure to the other two main measures out there, an Apache measure and a measure called SAPS, which you see mentioned in the biostatistician's comments on the measures. In addition to showing that the three models gave hospitals nearly identical performance scores. We did a time and motion study where we calculated the time required to collect the different data elements. And I'm going to get the number for SAPS wrong. It was in the middle, but the Apache number was 37 minutes. The SAPS number was 11 minutes, and the SAPS number was somewhere in the middle, 26 or something like that. And since we didn't get differences in predictive power, my 5-year-old has given me a cold. Since we didn't get differences in the predictions, but we did have a big difference in resource utilization, we ended up going with the MPM as the most cost-effective way to collect this data.
This is Sean O'Brien, the biostatistician. If I can ask a question, I was interested in comparisons to different models, and specifically, I didn't see specific mention of SAPS 3 rather than SAPS 2. And before answering your question,
sure.
I just wanted to give a background or some context that myself and probably the technical advisory panel thought that the methods, the documentation were excellent and, you know, achieved a level of validity that I was satisfied with. Something that comes up in the review of measures, my experience with other NQF activities, is that reviewers are asked to consider how this measure relates to other NQF-endorsed measures, and I think there maybe are no other NQF-endorsed measures currently. But in the future, just to anticipate an issue, another group may want to submit another related measure that's focusing on mortality for ICU stays or even length of stay. And in that case, the review committees or panels may be asked about a head-to-head comparison, because my impression is that NQF tries to reduce the number of competing measures. And so I suppose that's one reason why I was interested in specific head-to-head comparisons between related models.
So they announced the SAPS 3 model right after we had finished all our studies. But it's actually a fairly minor modification on SAPS 2, and even their own papers, it doesn't have a major impact on the predictive power of the model if you simply recalibrated SAPS 2 to current data and then compared it to SAPS 3. It's much better than the unrecalibrated SAPS 2, but any model that you use, ours or any others, you ought to recalibrate to your data over time anyway. There was one variable that we were missing from SAPS 3, and so we couldn't completely compare to that model.
Are there any other?
We did compare to SAPS 2.
Excuse me.
Sorry, go ahead.
Does the committee have any other questions? Okay. Dr. Doug, we thank you very much, and we hope you feel better.
Okay, thanks. I'm really fine.
Okay.
Thanks, Reva? All right. The next measure we're going to talk about is OT1007. This is hospital risk standardized complication rate following implantation of implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or ICD. This measure is from the folks at Yale and CMS. The measure provides hospital-specific risk standardized rates of procedural complications following the implantation of ICD-9 in Medicare fee-for-service patients at least 65 years of age. Measure uses clinical data available in the National Cardiovascular Disease Registry for risk adjustment that has been linked with CMS administrative claims data to identify the procedural complications. This measure was evaluated by the Cardiovascular Technical Advisory Panel, who rated it quite highly on the subcriteria for importance, noting that complication rates are reported in various sources anywhere from 8 to 16%. Under scientific acceptability, generally rated highly, it was noted that this measure captures Medicare patients greater than 65 and not those underneath, not those younger. It also does not capture the non-fee-for-service Medicare patients, which represents about 15% because of lack of data availability. This measure does use a registry, which is clinical data. It does have a risk model that is sort of aligned with the typical methodology that is used by the measure developers at Yale. NQF has endorsed a fair number of measures using this similar methodologies in the past, particularly around mortality. I think at this point we ought to let the committee discuss.
So it's Lee. I think I'm sharing this part. Harlan, do you want to make any comments first about any of the comments you've received back?
I'm not sure Harlan's on this call. I'm Jeff DeCurtis. I was the clinical lead on the development of the measures. I'm not sure what comments back you're referring to.
Did you get any of the comments from...
So this is Reva. The technical advisory panel has sent them some comments about auditing of the data in the registry, and they did provide a response about the data that was shown that the quality of the data is good for these kinds of data elements that are required. They compared it to chart abstraction and found that a large number of the hospitals had good agreement with abstracted data. The other question, again, was on how the measures address disparities. And for this particular measure, they have provided additional analyses of looking at how the measure results compare for folks in safety net hospitals and versus non, and found that there was really no difference between those hospitals and the others, and that the the range of hospital outcome for this measure were similar, irrespective of the SES status. So they have provided additional information to deal with that question that the TAP raised.
I guess the other question is, Sean, you had raised some questions from a statistical standpoint. Did you want to comment now?
I don't know if it came across my review, but I thought that the risk adjustment methodology was excellent. I participated in reviews of other related measures from the same group, and we commented on the documentation being exemplary. So I'd say a lot of my comments were maybe better suited for the technical advisory panel. At that level, I mean, there are specific issues that I thought were worth considering, and I certainly, in reading my comments, I made comments about suggesting that things needed to be considered before endorsement. And I think maybe that's beyond the scope of what I really was trying to do. I was just trying to raise issues rather than make any recommendations. So I think some of the big issues would have to do with the validation of the algorithm for identifying complications, and overall, I think not many issues.
Okay, thank you for clarifying.
This is Ted Gibbons from the Technical Advisory Panel. I think Dr. O'Brien made a couple of other points that we might want to address with the measure developer, which was one point that appeared to be minor, but I think is worth discussing, which is the time zero for the measure onset of reporting was discharge. Is that
yeah,
true?
Yeah, so that was a typo, and so probably carried over. It's the time zero is the date of the procedure itself, and as opposed to administrative data, we have pretty good, reasonably confident that we have good information about the date of procedure.
So it would capture all of the in-hospital complications.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. And do you have reservations at this time about how we would be able to capture complications by ICD-9 coding?
Yes, absolutely. This is certainly a first for our group to try this approach to use administrative data to capture the complications. We went through the process of internal chart review at Yale New Haven Hospital, reviewing 220 charts, and confirmed in those patients that there was a pretty high agreement between the two approaches of chart abstraction versus the administrative data. We did refine our codes a little bit to broaden them to identify, for instance, one additional pericardial synthesis that needed to be captured. We are in the process of a more detailed multi-center chart abstraction agreement study. And I unfortunately don't have any of those results available to you, but we're optimistic that we'll have that confirmed within the next 4 months or so. And it may be that we don't need to make any additions. It may mean that we need to do some additional modifications of the specific codes. But I think really, ultimately, they will be minor changes as opposed to large overhauls of the measure.
But certainly those were, I think, 15 incidents in the 202 patients at Yale New Haven Hospital. And do we have a sense of the broader list of common complications from the NCDR ICD registry database that would be complementary?
In fact, so you're asking the correlation between the occurrence of in-hospital complications in the NCDR as well as our VRs. There are a couple of difficulties with that. First, the NCDR complications were not part of the audited field, so the ones that are self-reported to the registry aren't part of the chart-abstracted auditing process that the NCDR has performed. They focused instead on the indications for primary prevention as the major focus. Second part of that, so self-reported data, we'd be a little sure what in fact is the gold standard. And so the second part is that the actual definitions of the complications used in the registry and the administrative data that we came up with vary in terms of how you define it. So in hematomas captured, as an example, in the registry, but we were capturing hematoma with blood transfusion, which in fact is not captured in the registry. That being said, those reservations aside, we did look, and there was, you know, a fairly good agreement between the two. But, you know, it was not perfect, and I wouldn't say that either one represents the gold standard.
Right. And Reva, if they do refinement of the definitions, that should not be a reason to delay voting on this measure, just as point of order?
That's ultimately a steering committee decision, but I can say that refinement of measures is sort of an ongoing process, and particularly with experience of measures, we expect that those refinements will be made as a matter of course. So unless you feel are there other reasons not to approve the measure? I wouldn't say that would be a particularly strong reason not
Thank you.
To.
Is there any other concerns from any of the steering committee members regarding the measure or the time horizon, which is the other thing that was addressed and I think answered?
This is David Hopkins. I have a couple. Number one, this measure and I think two or three of the others we are being asked to endorse are specified in terms of a particular insured population. And I don't think that's necessary or appropriate for NQF endorsement. So I'd like to see the definition of measure expressed in terms of demographic variables. It may be perfectly appropriate to have an age-specific denominator, but it shouldn't be payer-specific. And I don't see why that's a problem other than the fact that right now the data obviously exists for this particular population. I do understand that, but could be applied to others. Second issue is with the risk adjustment method. We've now had experience with measures that are based on hierarchical risk adjustment. And while I certainly find that the method is elegant and it's sort of a comfortable place for hospitals based on prior work, I'm very concerned that when this method is applied in practice, it really can't discriminate good performance from bad performance. And I appreciate if anybody saw Reva's message this morning that was responding to this and that came from the Yale group. I appreciate that it depends where you draw the threshold, but I think that if, you know, any reasonable application of a threshold, so if you're willing to stretch to confidence of 0.9, where the, you know, every time it's ever been done before is 0.95, I don't think there would be much discrimination. Now, I don't know that. And really what I would ask for is data from the developer that supplied the model to this Medicare data to show us what that distribution looks like. So, you know, you're right. We can the discussion of where the threshold goes is a separate discussion and really isn't part of the measure. But if the measure clusters everybody in the middle, it's not gonna be of much value. If our purpose is to endorse measures for public reporting and quality improvement, I just don't see the value in a measure that comes out saying everybody's average.
So can we address the second question first from the Yale group?
Yeah, sure. We've always struggled when we've gone through these endorsement processes as to what is being evaluated. Is it how the measure will ultimately be implemented or the characteristics of the measure itself? So I apologize if we may have been light on that information, but we've always tried not to constrain CMS to say this is going to be applied in this way and this is how they're going to define outliers, because that's not really what they contracted with us to provide for them. So that's one issue with it. Regarding whether, you know, the actual data and what it looks like when we do apply the hierarchical model to these hospitals, if I refer you to page 40, figure 6 of the accompanying methodology report, that figure, in fact, does demonstrate how the distribution of the risk standardized complication rates played out in this population. And
to your point, the bandwidth is actually quite narrow on this particular measure, and there is a lot of clustering of hospitals around the mean. I think there are a couple of reasons for that, ones that may not be replicated when the measure is actually implemented. First off, you know, we're working on a small population or a smaller population than the ICD than the overall group of patients receiving an ICD, because we lost about 30% in the matching process. So sample size at each hospital was reduced significantly on the basis of that. And the second is that those considerations of do we have enough cases, are we able to discriminate across hospital, may in fact influence the number of years that you use to accumulate cases for reporting. So as the committee may be aware, for instance, with the MI mortality measure, in the last year, the decision has been to change that from a one year's worth of patients for each hospital to a broader 3-year. And part of the purpose behind that is to, in fact, provide greater discrimination across hospitals.
But am I correct that this measure is defined in terms of 1 year?
Can we get an answer from?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Is the measure defined across 1 year, or could it be defined across multiple years, depending on sample size?
It could certainly be. It could be accrued across a number of years. In fact, when this measure was reviewed by the American College of Cardiology, had a separate review process, and they actually did it with the specification that they would request that multiple years be used to increase discrimination across hospitals.
We keep circling back to this issue about the hierarchical model, and, you know, I mean, I don't know whether we're going to keep doing this for a long, long time. If you're unsatisfied with the distribution, then we need to talk about that. But I really do believe that we've come to consensus that the use of the hierarchical modeling is the appropriate approach. And the fact that some hospitals are presenting us with less information upon which to make the determination, and so our best estimate of the performance pulls them toward the middle, is just the way it is. I mean, it's an acknowledgement of the fact that we don't have enough information, and we can go across more years, but it does seem the proper way to approach it. And the issue, I think, for the group is there some thread that you insist upon existing before you want to move ahead with the measure? And I would propose that I don't think you do, because sometimes there's not going to be a lot of spread, but the overall status quo is not good enough, and we're going to want to see improvement over time. Another thing is, you might have said, well, why'd you pick this? You know, why did you go here? You know, maybe there were areas that we could have gone that had more distribution. Maybe it might have been even higher priority for us. Well, we're trying to pioneer an approach where we're seeing whether or not we can work with registries to identify what might end up being a minimum data set that hospitals would submit. And in this case, pioneering an approach about complications, where we can work with the community. Imagine this, you know, we have to really negotiate with a lot of constituencies to pull around consensus so we can come to this day where we're before NQF with the full force of the profession behind us, talking about accountability for complications. There are a lot of compromises and issues along the way, but we had willing partners, we had a database that we could use, and we were able to go for this particular pioneering effort around complications that might serve as a template for future efforts. And it's true, here we didn't have an immense amount of spread, and the rates are relatively low. So there were some issues about sort of the intrinsic nature of this that made it not as ideal as you might find in other situations. But because we're trying to make traction, we're trying to set precedent. We're trying to do this in a rigorous way where we can go with willing partners at the beginning so we can generate momentum. That's what brings us to here. But the issue about, you know, yeah, well, you would find more variation if you didn't use hierarchical modeling. Yes, we would, but it wouldn't be proper in our opinion. And that's why we're not going in that direction. And so these are the kind of issues that are out here. I've also argued in the heart failure and the other readmission measures that we don't see a ton of variation. We see more in mortality, but at rates that are so high that we want to see over time an improvement, and we'll be able to compare years later on.
May I respond to that? Because I think you've made some excellent points, and I, you know, I want to second your point about how important it is to work with the community and develop a way of looking at these important outcomes. And so credit to everybody who's been working on this. I'm only concerned that in the end, the community won't be well served if, you know, we use the super safe risk adjustment method as opposed to one that either stratifies in a small number of categories that preserves enough sample, or, you know, is a little outside this totally safe zone for the providers so that one can identify, you know, those that may be using best practices and those that may need some help. That's where you would want to go with this, I would think.
Well, and I totally appreciate what you're saying and think it's very important. And the question is whether or not that ought to be best handled by saying, you know, you don't have to be, you know, you don't need a 95% interval estimate here. I mean, when you're talking about these kind of outcomes, that you can go with a 90% or an 80% interval estimate when you're trying to go against. Or what I've argued is when you're looking for outliers, instead of saying how different are you from the median performance, I want to know how different are they from the top 25 percentile. And because I'm trying to push everybody towards that goal. So if you're significantly worse than the top 25th percentile, then you need to really address your performance. But these are issues that are sort of post-processing once the measure is approved and is around sort of discussions. And I agree with you. I mean, you don't want a measure where everyone can feel complacent. You want a measure that is going to get everyone to aspire to be as good as the best.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's going to be around, I think we're going to need to sell the community on that, and that's going to be around how outliers are identified later. And as I understand it, that's not something that gets approved through this process.
Well, I'm okay.
We really need to. Are there others who want to comment on this?
Yeah, I just want to ask a point of information. Do we have that distribution curve that was referred to? I looked for something that had page 40 in it. Couldn't find anything, Reva. Do we have that?
Yes, it was sent to you in the zip file with the measure submission form. It's in there. I can resend it for you if you'd like.
I've got the measure submission form in front of me, and it's not 40 pages long.
Okay. No. There were multiple documents in a zip file.
Okay. Thanks.
Anybody else have any comment with regard to the hierarchical models?
This is Sean O'Brien. I just wanted to make a comment about this issue about endorsing a measure versus the implementation, and I feel that certain aspects of the implementation are just intrinsic to the measure and that you really need to endorse a specific implementation so that the choice between 1 versus 3 years for an observation window has really important implications for whether those sample sizes are useful enough to provide meaningful information. And so it really gets to the heart of the usefulness and validity. On the other hand, if you go with a 3-year time window, that also has validity issues in the sense that you may be measuring performance that is not current performance versus... So I didn't have a specific opinion about the adequacy of those sample sizes, but I do have an opinion that they need to be kind of part of the package that gets discussed and endorsed, in my opinion.
Thank you. Any other comments with regard to those two points? Can we address the original point, either Reva or Helen, about the use of only the fee-for-service Medicare patients?
Sure, this is Helen. David, while I agree that we'd certainly like all of our measures to move towards more global specifications for the broader population, I think that at times there are measures that come in that are appropriate given the data source. And I think that's the instance here. We've had discussions with the Yale Group and CMS about the need to potentially look at modifying the model so that it could be used for other populations, but I don't think that's the measure in front of us. But I think it's a very worthy, question once again to pose back to CMS and the Yale team about how difficult would it be to create a non-Medicare model for use by the non-Medicare sector. But I don't think it's directly relevant to evaluation of the measure before us today.
So, Helen, let me understand something.
Sure.
Is the risk model not open source? I'm sure it is.
This model is fully open source, but, and again, Harlan, feel free to weigh in, but my sense of it, the risk model has been validated on a population over age 65. We would want to see whether, in fact, the risk model holds up for the under 65 population. Might there be other factors or some factors that shouldn't be in the model when you're looking at younger patients?
You could satisfy me if you just had the denominator defined in terms of over age 65. It's the payer specific.
I see.
Definition that troubles me.
It's really just an issue of practical implementation of it. There's no way that at this point you can collect all that data on either all non-Medicare fee-for-service patients. That's the only way to get these complications out. So if there were a broader group of data that we could use, certainly we have, you know, we'd love that opportunity to broaden out the measure so we can really, truly represent the experience of all patients at each hospital. But I think practically that's not going to happen for the near future.
It sounds like an implementation issue that initially it will be applied to that population, but why can't the measure be defined more broadly?
I guess you could define it more broadly, but would it have enough face validity for people to say, well, you don't have any mechanism of implementing this, why would we ever endorse it? You know, so as opposed to, we took the approach of, let's define this measure in accordance with how it's most likely going to be applied, at least in its first iterations. Again, we in measure maintenance would love to broaden this out if that opportunity presents itself down the road. But
are you sure also, it's Lee, whether or not the models would be valid in the other population?
Right, we'd be making an assertion that we could not test.
This is Ruben Singham. I think that's vital. I mean, I don't think the NQF should be endorsing a measure if it's not been validated in a specific population.
That was my point.
Well, I think that's true, but I think in many cases, you know, it's tested on a population and then applied much more broadly and endorsed in a way that enables it to be applied more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, David, I completely agree with you, and I know there's some ongoing work, for example, at the Institute of Medicine right now looking at how to move towards quality measurement for the Medicare Advantage plans, for example. I think it would be very reasonable for the steering committee to, you know, again, make a strong recommendation that we, you know, attempt to try to get some of these really important outcome measures specified for the under 65 non-fee-for-service Medicare population.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other comments, or shall we move on? Okay, Reva, can you take us to the next measure?
Sure. The next measure that we're going to talk about is 008, Hospital 30-Day Risk Standardized Readmission Rates Following Percutaneous Coronary Intervention, or PCI. This is measure estimates the hospital risk standardized 30-day readmission rates following PCI in Medicare fee-for-service patients at least 65 years of age. As patients may be admitted electively for staged procedures, elective readmission is excluded. The measure uses clinical data available in the National Cardiovascular Disease Registry, CAS PCI Registry, for risk adjustment that has been linked with CMS administrative claims data to identify the readmissions. This measure is one more in a growing family of measures brought to us by the folks at Yale that look at 30 days all-cause readmissions. NQF has already endorsed measures for AMI, heart failure, pneumonia. We've also endorsed PCI mortality rate for which this is aligned as well. So this is a growing family focused in on these issues, all using sort of a similar approach and methodology. In this particular case, they are able to use registry data, which provides clinical data to help really narrow down some of the clinical issues. The technical advisory panel looked at this measure. The issues that were raised during their discussion were not unlike the issues that were raised in previous discussions of similar measures. The issue around including all-cause readmissions rather than procedure-specific or condition-specific causes for readmission. There were discussions around the time frame of 30 days, perhaps 15 days might capture things more specific to the procedure, though 30 days is harmonized with the other readmission and mortality measures. Also, CAP members discussed that often the decisions for readmission of a patient is in various hands depending on the local circumstances where the driving force may lie with the emergency room physicians rather than with the proceduralist, and that is highly variable among institutions. In this particular case, the TAP had a fair number of questions that the measure developer has provided additional information that was given to the steering committee. One particular question was data on the readmissions or ED visits at other sites of care, in which it was looked at that 26% of the readmissions were to a different hospital rather than the hospital of the procedure, and a distribution graph was provided demonstrating that. Another question was whether there was any data on the differences between a PCI that a procedure that was associated with an acute MI during that hospitalization or not, and basically the developers advised that prior work had demonstrated overall readmission rate higher for patients with a primary diagnosis of MI compared to others, 17.5 versus 13%. However, in the process of the measure development, they considered whether to group those patients or not, but ultimately they included the AMI status as part of the risk model to account for differences in those two populations. They wanted to know about if there was overlap between the endorsed AMI readmission measure for these patients that also have a PCI during that AMI measure, and an analysis of the actual data showing that 29% had a principal diagnosis suggestive of the AMI in the claims data, and so they felt that the majority of patients captured in this PCI measure are not included in the AMI measure. And again, similar question about the auditing, about looking at the quality of the data elements, and then also additional rationale on the 30-day time frame. They presented a chart or a graph that shows the hazard of readmission versus time frames, and clearly it's highest in the 0 to 15-day period and declines through the 15 to 30-day period and plateaus somewhat after 35 days. And so that just demonstrates the capture at different time frames. And then the last question was the data on the causes of readmission between the initial 15 days and the 15 to 30 days, and they've provided graphs indicating the causes of readmission in those two time frames and representing a very similar diagnoses as causes for admission. And then lastly, again, a similar analysis done on the question about addressing disparities, finding that the results really did not vary for safety net hospitals compared to others. So those are the issues that were raised and have been addressed so far.
This is Ted Gibbons from the TAP on this measure. Two other issues that came up in discussion and I think they were highlighted as well as by Dr. O'Brien, were the fact that outpatient PCIs may not be included, and the other is that death after discharge without a readmission has not been accounted for, and I was wondering if the measure developers could comment on that.
So specifically for observation stay or outpatient PCIs, those are included in the measure. I hope we made that clear in the methodology report. So we capture those patients by using Part A outpatient hospital data.
Okay.
And, of course, there are all hospitals that participate in CAP-PCI commit to submitting data on all PCIs. So the submission of the data to the NCDR is not contingent on whether or not they're an inpatient or outpatient. And I think we capture both sets of populations in the administrative data. And the second question?
The other question was, is death after discharge without readmission captured
Right, so there's no censoring of patients by death after discharge, and in this way, this particular measure parallels the same approach that's been taken for the other paired mortality readmission measures of pneumonia, MI, and heart failure. I think that it's good in the sense that the measures are paired by condition or procedure, and that there is in fact a joint accountability for both types of outcomes. I believe that it's mainly a statistical consideration of these models that you can't censor patients for death. And I believe that's why the approach has been taken for those previous efforts.
Thank you very much. I had one other comment, which is that we've received quite a bit of healthy discussion from interventionists about the utility of this measure, and I think it's important for the NQF to state fairly clearly about what we are actually measuring. We are not measuring the quality of the intervention itself, but the quality of the follow-up and the systems issues that can relate to readmission.
It also would be the transition of care at the end. It does measure the quality of care in the hospital or outpatient setting and the transition to the outpatient setting. Are you
absolutely
suggesting it would not?
No, I'm saying that it is. I think that there has been some greater emphasis on trying to narrow the way readmission is captured by excluding non-cardiac related diagnoses in the readmission hospitalization. But I think that because the focus has been on, by the interventionists on what does that have to do with the intervention itself. But I think what I'm saying is I'm supporting your philosophy that this really is a manifestation of systems management and inadequacy of the transition of care of this patient, not just a measure about the technical aspects of the PCI itself.
Right, and we agree with that completely. I mean, we want to emphasize that, in fact, this is absolutely not a measure of interventional cardiologists, and it's not necessarily a comment on the care that's delivered in the lab, but rather the broader process of care for this large group of patients that undergoes these procedures. And it actually, in comparison with some of the other populations for which we have the readmission measures, this is, by and large, at most hospitals that perform PCI, a relatively cohesive group. They're generally geographically in a limited set of locations. The processes of care are maybe more modifiable than they are for other conditions that we measure. So in some ways, this represents perhaps there's more upside on this measure even than on some of the ones that are currently being applied.
Thank you. I think, Joyce, did you have a specific question?
No, I'm okay. Thanks.
Dr. O'Brien's comments?
I think it's all right. I think we should move on.
Are there any other comments or questions so that we continue to evaluate the other measures?
I have a comment. This is Amy Rosen. I'm concerned that adoption of or endorsement of a measure of readmission of a procedure implies that there's some kind of gold standard for a rate of readmission. We really don't know that. We don't know what readmission rates would be, what the gold standard would be for those. So I'm concerned that once this gets endorsed, hospitals that are higher than expected on this procedure might, you know, be dinged unnecessarily.
Maybe someone
have information
from
on that?
Comment on that rather than the measure developer?
Excuse me?
I was just wondering if either Reva or Helen might comment rather than the measure developer on that philosophical question.
I don't know. No, not especially. I mean, I think it's an, you know, I think it was something that Ted probably filled you in on. It was a discussion at the TAP level as well. I think the issue Lee raised for, you know, really summed it up, which it is still reflective of the care afterwards and the transition.
I don't think that the measure developers can comment, but I think that nobody is saying there's a specific rate yet. They're right. Benchmarking to in order to improve, and that's the philosophy with all of these measures.
Right, and NQF does not require that there be a specific benchmark. There have been measures put forward where we think the number should be low, but we don't know exactly what that is, and I think that's part of the purpose of moving towards public reporting is to get a sense of what is the range of performance.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm just concerned about eventual, you know, endorsement and adoption of this because we have readmission measures for medical conditions but not for procedures. And so that's raising this issue to another level, I think.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, this is just David Hopkins. I have the same two issues with this measure.
Do the measure developers or
want
to comment?
I think we discussed it. Yeah, it's okay.
So would you like me to comment on that or not?
Sure, briefly.
Right. I mean, I just think that I don't really understand necessarily why you're drawing a distinction between a condition and a procedure. Ultimately, at the end of the day, these are vulnerable populations of patients who are, in fact, being readmitted quite often. And every interventional cardiologist we talk to, every person that we've reviewed this data with, is blown away by the readmission rates for this population. In general, patients undergoing angioplasty are much healthier than most of the rest of the Medicare population. And the perceived readmission rates were really much lower than that. And, in fact, this has been confirmed to be a problem for populations beyond the Medicare group, where they've looked at managed care data, HMO data, and they found similar readmission rates in that group. So I think it's a big problem. I don't see it being that different for a condition versus a procedure. I don't think that should be a barrier for it moving forward.
I'm sorry you misunderstood me. I totally agree with you on that. My two issues were, again, defined in terms of a specific payer population, and based on the comments you just gave, it sounds like this actually has been applied to other over 65-year-olds that are not in fee-for-service. And then I see, again, a pretty profound clustering to the mean. And I now have your technical report in front of me after risk adjustment.
Right. So I think the same responses apply to both from the ICD.
But back to the condition versus the procedure thing, I think that it would be, you know, this is a measure that would be understood by patients experiencing this procedure. I think it would be really salient.
Agree.
Thank you. I think then we should move it back to Reva.
Yeah. Okay, we have two more measures to discuss, and these are the measures, two very similarly specified measures for COPD patients undergoing pulmonary rehabilitation. This is particularly timely in that CMS has instituted a new benefit for pulmonary rehabilitation as of January 2010, where we're likely to see increased numbers of programs for pulmonary rehab as well as increased referrals to pulmonary rehab. So the goal of pulmonary rehabilitation for patients with this chronic disease are to improve their quality of life and increase their functioning. These measures do address some important outcomes that the steering committee has identified, both quality of life and functional outcomes, and in that case, and in that sense, are really some of the first ones we've seen addressing those types of outcomes. One of the things I think before I get into any of the details, is these measures as both include tools embedded in them that have been well-researched, published, and well-validated. So the tools that are embedded in the measures have certainly been tested. But neither of these measures has been tested as a quality measure, so that there are a lot of unknowns in terms of some of the questions have been posed about how this measure would perform in assessing performance by providers. So that is a common theme that kind of came across in the discussions of the various data inputs. And one thing I just want to share with everyone is there is an evolving thinking here at NQF around how we deal with measures that have not gone through any significant testing or field testing or use of any kind so that we understand how they behave. And previously, those who are familiar with it may know that we have had an option for a time-limited endorsement that allows a two-year endorsement for untested measures to allow testing to be accomplished in that period of time, and then a final decision on endorsement is made. However, I will tell you that in December, NQF's Board of Directors has revisited that policy and has revised the policy to significantly narrow that application. And so this project is sort of caught in a changing time frame about how we, you know, should handle measures that have not gone through some testing to understand its behavior. And I think there is voiced concerns at many levels around particularly outcome measures or particularly complex measures that contain risk adjustment about moving them forward for endorsement without being tested. And I'd ask Helen Burston if she wanted to add anything more to that.
I think Reva summed it up. I think from our perspective, we would really look to the steering committee's best guidance here. The part of the logic for the narrowing the scope of allowing untested measures to come into the process was concerns that particularly complex measures, those with risk adjustment, for example, or composites, people felt strongly really needed to be testing before they got looked at by steering committees. The issue, I think, before you today is that I think this project is sort of in a transition point, and I think you should really use your best judgment as to whether or not some of the measures that come forward that are untested should really proceed, or do they really need to go back and be tested before you take a closer look at them. The 12-month window is definitely the new requirement, though, as we get a better handle on exactly what we mean by complex measures going forward.
Jewel, I think that for measures like the health-related quality of life measure that's before us, overwhelmingly the ones that are out there that I use anyway in physical therapy or that we use have not been designed to be provider-level measures. They've been designed to be patient-level measures. So I think if, in fact, we NQF really feels strongly that going forward this needs to be an expectation, that has to be made loud and clear across the industry to folks, made known, because it's not the way these measures were designed. So I would make that point. The second point I would say is that I would hope we could find a way to think about the measures that are before us a little differently in that regard, because I think if, in fact, we had to stick to that, we wouldn't need to talk about these measures today.
So this is Ivor Jester, just a clarification question. Are we then to discuss whether we believe this measure has been adequately tested in its for its ability to discriminate between the quality of different providers or different skilled therapist organizations versus, in other words, based on what you just said, if we don't believe that this has been tested for its ability to distinguish amongst providers or amongst the quality provided by those providers, then it's a slam dunk, well, let's put this on the shelf, go ahead, test it, come back after you're done. Is that what we're discussing?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, Ivor. This is Helen again. We actually are having a measure testing task force next week to really kind of dive deeper into what we mean by testing, which is why I think we're still in this in-between phase. There seems to be a fair amount of confusion. We really are focused on the reliability and the validity of the measure, the scientific acceptability of the measurement properties here. So in this instance, my understanding is there's a tool that's been validated, but the question is, has the measure, would the measure satisfy your needs in terms of a reliable and valid estimate of
But even that sort of begs the question, because it might be extremely reliable and valid in distinguishing between, yes, I'm better than I used to be, or no, I'm not better than I used to be, me as a patient. But it might not be valid or reliable for distinguishing between physical therapy center A or respiratory center A and B.
That's correct.
In fact, I wonder if we could get invited to listen in on that call, just so we can learn more about testing, or hear an audio summary of it or something.
Yeah, we'll definitely post the audio summary. It's a small all-day meeting next week, so we'll definitely get that out.
Anyway, those two forms of reliability and validity, could you comment on that? Because we need to, that'll help us know what we're voting on.
This is Chris Garvey. I wanted to comment on the measure of functional status. The formal guidelines were published by the American Thoracic Society in 2002, and in those guidelines, they argue that six-minute walk test is actually even more reproducible than a pulmonary function test. So the ATS has very specific, very clear guidelines, how the test is performed, what the provider can say, what the path is, you know, how it's laid out. So it's extremely specific. Fortunately, it's also very simple, easy to complete, easy to measure, easy to report accurately. So it has a very broad history of being used in not only heart disease, not only lung disease, but heart disease and other medical disorders. But I appreciate your comments about a manner to measure and hopefully guarantee the quality of the data.
This is Barbara Yon, and having been on the TAP, again, I think you very nicely answered some of the questions people had about the six-minute walk test. but translating that six-minute walk test back to distinguishing the quality of two has not been done. And yes, that's a very nice, very valid measure. The CRQ, which is a quality of life measure, has been validated as a self-administered measure, which removes a whole bunch of the questions we got too. And so it's very easy to use, and it has been shown to change over time, and that is related to the patient's quality of life. But neither one of these has been related to the quality of the intervention that may be associated with those changes in either functional status or quality of life. And this is one of those things that, do we make that leap of faith? And I think some of us are saying we might be a little uncomfortable making that leap of faith at the moment.
Right.
No testing.
And this is Dion Jewell. If I could just add to that, though, part of, I guess for me, my interest in having these measures go forward in a time, because I'm the one who made the comments in the straw poll commentary about time limited, is that part of the testing is that we need the aggregate data. I mean, we need a large amount of data to be able to make those inferences, and the testing process allows us to do that. I guess I feel comfortable with these particular measures because they're so well validated at the individual level that I would feel it's a shame to have to shelve them now and wait until there's some adequate testing period, particularly given that this is a relatively new decision by the NQF board.
One of the things I do want to point out, you know, you talk about the six-minute walk being very well validated. They did use a different distance as a significant difference than the one that I believe is well validated in the literature, and so we might want to comment on that.
Okay.
And the minimal clinical difference in the quality of life, they doubled that, and I have no problem saying we want to assess double what is in the literature as the minimal clinically significant difference.
But sure.
I think Barbara's comment is important because Ann Holland just published a research article that looked at a minimally clinical important difference in the six-minute walk of 25 yards in COPD, which is different from the Redemeyer value that was published in 1996.
Mm-hmm. And that was in your response, if I remember correctly?
Yes.
Yes, it was. And this is Jereen Baldup. Back to the health-related quality of life. As we had discussed at the TAP meeting and as we put in our responses, that we went with the moderate change, which was the 1.0, that we got the impression from the TAP that they would prefer to see us use the 0.5, which would be absolutely acceptable to the developers. So we have no issue with, I think we were trying to be much more conservative. I think we were concerned that if we looked just for a small difference, that might not be considered enough of a difference from a quality standpoint. So we would be happy to, you know, follow the direction that you deliver to us, but that we are more than happy. We don't have to use the 1.0 as in our responses. We're happy to go back to the 0.5.
Well, since the measure hasn't been tested, when it's tested, it could be tested with both values.
Yes, it certainly could. Mm-hmm.
So I want to go back to, this is Lee, to the question of testing and the appropriateness of testing in an endorsed time-limited measure, which is the old standard versus what we heard was a new standard. And my concern being that although we have a very valid measure, clinical, individual difference, a measure of quality of care by the provider, and I'd really like some more guidance regard to the appropriateness even in this transition period. So I guess I'm directing this to Reva, because I am concerned about endorsing something that not been shown to necessarily even reflect on quality.
Yeah. This is Reva. I would say that one of the quandaries that a measure that has not been tested is there are a lot of questions, such as you raised, about what is the appropriate threshold for the minimal clinical difference and the fact that changed on the distance on the six-minute walk. those are usually the types of things that are figured out when you test the measure to see how it performs. Also, the relationship to quality, I think, is not well understood at this point, and again, some validation work is useful to help understand the relationship to quality better. So I think the lack of testing puts the steering committee in a difficult position of trying to evaluate how a measure meets the criteria. And in many cases, particularly the reliability or validity testing, you simply have no information to guide you. And I think it puts you in a very, very difficult spot. And I would echo Barbara's comment that there would have to be a bit of a leap of faith recommend the measure when you just have a lot of unknown information.
This is Ruben Omersingham. I also am expressing reservation about endorsing this without requisite testing of whether or not this affects, this reflects on the quality of the provider, because you know, a lot of providers are trying to make decisions about where to put resources, and I think this is an excellent area for future direction. But, you know, it seems to me there could be a lot of issues that may not be the provider's fault. For example, if the patient isn't fully compliant with the regimen that's being prescribed or coming to appointments and so forth, how is that affected? Are we stratifying by some of the other factors we talked about before, SES status and other things like that? Has it been, you know, tested in a way that you can definitively say a provider was at fault or could have done a better job to improve the quality and the outcomes? And I just wonder if it's dangerous to start moving in that area without really having this research, even though it would be lovely to have a measure like this.
And just to clarify, NQF already has two time-limited endorsed measures that are just like this, not the performance-based measure, but the AMPAC and the photo instruments were exactly in that boat when we endorsed them 2 years ago for a time-limited fashion. So I don't know what we've learned from that process, for better or for worse. I mean, I totally agree that with the concerns and the questions of link to quality at the provider level that have been expressed, but I just, for the record, want to be sure that we understand that this isn't, we wouldn't be asked to be doing something we haven't already done.
No, but could you give us follow-up on those, the two measures that were on the time limited? During that 12 months, were these types of validation assessments done, and were they then brought back so that NQF could say, oh, yes, we now know, and now we can either approve or disapprove? Were those things actually done?
This is Helen. Just to let you know, at least on the photo measures, we used to have a 24-month window for testing. So they're still within that window. We have not received their testing results yet.
Okay. Yeah, I'm very worried that 12 months is a tremendously short time, especially with what we all know about pulmonary rehab right now, that the requirements for what a pulmonary rehab absolutely must have didn't come out all that long ago. CMS is going to be funding some care for a few people if they can meet all the many, many requirements. So it's in such a state of flux that asking them to do that in 12 months, I'm not sure that's at all realistic.
So I was just wondering if there are some, if for those of us who have reservations about endorsing this but also think it's an excellent measure, is there a way, Reva, in our votes, that we can capture that?
Well, I think ultimately at this point, the decision for the steering committee is a fairly yes or no kind of vote. I mean, if you are comfortable enough pushing this ahead for endorsement, you're going to vote for it. But if you feel that it's premature or that the questions that testing could answer need to be available before you can make that decision, I think it would be difficult for the steering committee to approve it at this point in time. You know, ultimately, the steering committee is the decision-making body, and these are the issues that are placed in front of you for you to make that decision.
Right, and this is Helen. Just one more caveat to what Reva just said. You know, this is, you know, these functional status measures are quite different in a new area. So, you know, part of what the steering committee's role really is kind of identifying the measures they would put forward. I mean, all measures go forward for public comment regardless. But that, you know, if you wanted to, you know, put it forward as this is really an area where the steering committee had questions and just gather public input, that's a certainly a possibility as well.
This is Pauline McNulty. Can I just ask a clarifying question? Because we're jumping back and forth between talking about the 6-minute walk test as a functional assessment and the CRQ as a health-related quality of life measure. And I distinguish between the two in that the 6-minute walk test is something that's observable by somebody else, mm-hmm. therefore is not, you know, literally reported by the patient, him or herself. So I'm not sure if we're talking about voting on these as a pair or separately. That's one question that I have.
They would be voted separately,
okay.
unless the committee determined that they should be paired. But you, as steering committee, would vote on them separately.
No, I don't think they should be paired. That's my point. I think they're quite different in the way that they're reported. One is observable by, you know, another person, and the CRQ is self-reported by the patient. The other question that I have goes back to what Deanna Jewell was talking about much earlier in the conversation with regard to the health-related quality of life measure, and I wanted to know from her perspective as somebody who's involved in rehabilitation and the TAP people, if this is a measure that would be commonly used in that area and if it's acceptable to them, or if there are other measures out there that just simply were not submitted. Because, you know, from my perspective, given the world that I work in, I know that there are, you know, tons of measures that are out there for, you know, particular diseases, different therapeutic areas, and it may very well be that you know, not everybody knows to submit measures to NQF, given that this is fairly new, in that the, you know, the patient reported measures would be fairly new to for developers to know about to submit to NQF. So it's a long question, but just curious as to whether you could provide some kind of light on that.
And this is Deanne. There are several other measures out there that pulmonary rehab programs or folks working with these patients might use that are also well validated, but I would venture to say that none of them have been implemented for the purposes of assessing quality at the provider level. And so I, you know, in that sense, I'm completely understanding in terms of the hesitation that some of our colleagues are feeling about endorsing at this point in time. I just think that's going to be a universal problem for all measures like this for any patient population, so that's why I'm feeling a lean toward the old time limited way of doing things.
Helen, it's Barbara, I was on the TAP, Barbara Yon. I wanted to comment on a couple of things you said. One of the recognized beneficial outcomes of pulmonary rehab is improvement of patients' quality of life. So it is a very appropriate outcome to be assessed. And the CRQ has been used in many studies, and it is one of the ones that has been validated as self-administered. Several of the others are not. The St. George, for example, is quite long and not easy to use in a timely fashion, and it's probably the other most validated quality of life tool for COPD patients. So, and I really am concerned about, well, we can observe this, but we can't observe that. If we did it that way, then probably all of our mental health measures would just go right out the window, and I'm not very happy about that idea. So I don't see that the CRQ is any less valid because we can't observe it than the 6-minute
walk. Oh, I'm sorry, you've got me completely wrong, because
good.
I'm in patient-reported outcomes, so I'm completely on the same side of the page as you, Barbara, that I believe implicitly that the patient should be able to self-report. Really, what I was just, my first comment was about the distinction between the six-minute walk test, that that is an observable one, versus the CRQ, which is a PRO. And so that really was, my question was around, you know, whether they were being combined together to vote on, because I didn't see them as the same.
Yeah.
So with regard to your point, I'm in complete agreement with you that I think it's very important, and I'm really glad that things have moved in this direction and that NQF is incorporating them, you know, into quality measures. I think we're, you know, at the threshold of something new, and that's a breakthrough. And I think implicit in that, there will be some difficulties with regard to, you know, how do we do it, how do we interpret it, and so on. But I am completely in favor of putting one foot in front of the other and moving ahead and see how it works.
Great. Thank you.
Helen, it's Joyce. It's a process question.
Sure.
If the steering committee decides that this measure doesn't meet the new time-limited criteria,
mm-hmm.
The measure would still be put out for public comment. Is that correct?
Yes. All measures go out for public
okay.
comment regardless.
But is there any way my impression is that when a measure is not recommended by the steering committee, then people don't think they have to comment on it. And
No. We actually get just as many comments on the non-recommended as recommended.
Okay. So there would be an opportunity to throw this out and get public comment on this measure, and it would still have a chance for the steering committee to reconsider it if we
Absolutely.
Got overwhelming pushback, depending on which direction we went in.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think that's really important.
And do we, Helen, get to tell them what was the major reason for recommendation?
Yeah, absolutely, in either direction. And at times we've also put out measures without consensus on the part of the steering committee saying, you know, the committee was really so split on this one. There were real concerns. Here are the concerns. Please weigh in. So I think, you know, that you have a fair amount of latitude. I think especially in some of these newer measurement areas that, frankly, are just uncharted territory.
This is Patch. I have a clarification question. It sounds like we can vote against a measure or for the measure, but can we vote for the measure with time limitation? This is unclear to me. It sounds like there are three choices.
Yeah, the only way this measure could go forward, Patch, would be time limited because it has not been tested.
Got it. Now, what is the advantage of voting for a time-limited measure in order to be tested rather than just having the developers test it?
The only advantage would be that it would become potentially part of the set of endorsed NQF measures, and people might want to begin using it with the caveat that it has not yet been tested.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
This is Doreen Bottle from AACBPR. Just a clarification question. I got the impression that if it was declined, that we were not allowed to come back in. So if it would be declined because it's not been tested, once we completed testing, we would be able to bring it back?
We need to think of that. We'd probably have to talk to you offline about the timing of it and whether there's another vehicle that we could move it through in the near term.
Okay.
This is Anita in Michigan. How are you? I had a question in regard to more kind of a general, looking at that there is so much data with quality of life improvement with pulmonary rehab. Is the question really more because of the variability, because of the different elements that are used in each pulmonary rehab that we're trying to see if there's a difference pre and post? Or should the question really be just that, are you using the following elements because those lead to improvement in quality of life?
Good question.
Vineet, are you asking about the intent of the measure?
I'm trying to understand, like, the first thing you have to look at is importance to measure and report. And when I was looking through all the literature, and, I mean, it's come out in the conversations with different people, too, it's pretty well understood that pulmonary rehab improves the quality of life. But the problem is there's many different elements that could be used in a pulmonary rehab, and maybe some are only using certain ones and others are using all of them. And I believe that is happening here in Southeast Michigan from after I talking to a few of the pulmonologists in the area. So is the question improving quality of life before or after really addressing, is the main issue more, are we trying to decrease the intervariability that's used for pulmonary rehab and we just want to make it more standardized so we can get the improvement in quality of life which has already been published and known?
You know, this is Reva. What I would say is
in the discussions, the intent of the measure was actually to measure the effectiveness of the pulmonary rehab program as manifested by a change in the quality of life from the beginning of the program to the end of the program. So it was more about the effectiveness of whatever was done such that it was measured through change in the outcome. I think that there is discussion around the definition of pulmonary rehab and what the contents and what the services are that are part of that, but I believe the intent of the measure was really the outcome from the effectiveness of the program.
So we're going to have people measure something and really not know what they're using for their rehab, and we'll have a pre and post. How is that going to tell us what we need to change to improve quality of life measure so that it does become a standardized 80% acceptance level or something like that?
This is Chris Garvey. I can comment on that. We would be doing this as part of ACVPR, and we're developing a database for programs that have achieved certification, ACVPR certification, which is a similar concept to Joint Commission accreditation. So programs have to meet certain provision standards, certain quality standards, and have certain elements of quality, safety, program management, and the data would be collected in that database. I think an argument for looking at it in this manner is, up until now, there have been very few multi-center studies looking at the impact of pulmonary rehab on quality of life. So it is a very different, much broader way of measuring quality of measuring the impact of pulmonary rehab on quality of life. We do have a minimal criteria that programs have to provide in terms of the pulmonary rehabilitation intervention.
Okay, thank you for that. And the second question, I think someone else had mentioned it. Forgive me, I don't remember your name. Because of the dependence on patients to come and learn all these things and the multiple visits they're going to have to do, is there any qualifier for that? And then forgive me again if you've already answered this for a former question, but is there something where certain patients could be not put into the denominator because they didn't follow through with the whole proceed, you know, meeting 80% of the appointments or something like that, some threshold cutoff?
That would be described in the data analysis. They do have to attend a minimum of 6 weeks, twice a week, and the intervention does need to include exercise.
Okay, so their health system or physician group, they would be clear that their denominator doesn't include everyone that they just wrote a prescription, told them to do this, but only those who met those criteria.
Correct.
Correct.
There is a specific statement that pulmonary rehab quitters, they're defined, are excluded. So that is there.
This is Dionne, and this is probably for Reva and Helen for future conversation, but I'm fascinated by this question about patient adherence and contribution to the outcome, because I would venture to guess that that has relevance across pretty much any measure we could toss up, and yet you don't hear it being talked about relative to readmissions and other things, so maybe I just need a private tutorial as to why it's only relevant now and not perhaps as relevant in other cases, but I just throw that out there.
No, I think it's an excellent point. I mean, it came up very prominently, for example, even at the diabetes discussion yesterday about blood pressure control, smoking cessation, so I think it is a fairly common concern about, you know, what's the complete locus of accountability and the involvement of the patient. So I agree, it's not unique to this measure.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing it up. This is Barbara. I was going to bring it up, too, because, you know, some of that, I believe, is due to the quality of the program. If it's not interesting and they don't like it, they won't come back. So I agree. I don't think it should always be excluded.
So this is Lee. Reva, do we need to go on to the public?
I was just going to say we're real short on time. I really would like to be sure we don't miss our public comment opportunity. So, Lynn, are you still there with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Operator? Yeah, we need to open up for Q&A and see if anybody wants to make any comments.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Okay, we'll see if anyone out there has a comment.
At this time, there are no questions.
Okay. Do we have anybody out there in the audience? Okay. We just want to be sure anybody has an opportunity to...
Do you have a few people? Would you like me to just open all lines?
No, just if nobody's asking a question, that's fine.
Okay.
They have the opportunity. Okay. Lee and Joyce, I guess there doesn't seem to be any comments from folks in the audience. So I guess at this point, it's next steps. I am, from what I've heard from the discussion today, I think it would be feasible for me to send out a decision voting SurveyMonkey tool to the group to collect your formal votes on the measure evaluation criteria, the four main criteria, as well as the recommendation. And given that all of these measures would then go out for public comment, we will characterize them based on the comments throughout this whole long process, as well as the votes received. Any questions about that?
Can you tell us something about the timing, Reba?
It's in terms of sending it out.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully by tomorrow.
No, I don't mean that. I mean in terms of when we can.
You said how long it would be out there for. Typically when we send something out like that, it'd be nice if it was a week. Remember that this group has another phone call in a week from today on the 24th when you have six additional measures. So it probably would be easier on you if you took care of business around these six measures and then can, you know, change your attention to those six measures we'll be discussing next week.
Hear, hear.
Does that work?
Yes, we're not going to return to these six.
Okay.
Reva, quick question. Is there, in the vote that you're going to be sending out, is it going to have options like yes with recommendations, no, or yes with, you know, two-year provision?
Yeah, I mean, we'll give you the options. Typically, it's recommend with conditions. And remember that a recommend with conditions is a no vote unless that condition can be met and is met within our time frame. And then whenever, for the measures for pulmonary rehab that haven't been tested, the recommendation would only be for time-limited endorsement because that's the only avenue for them. So your options will be laid out with explanation on what that means and what the implications are.
But, you know, we talked earlier about submitting and saying yes with the strong recommendation for some of the earlier measures on
right.
When we talked about stratification for SES and things like that.
Yes.
Will you express the vote that way, Reva?
Yes, I'll add a second one just to be clear that it's voted that way.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Okay, thank you so much.